yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show, Alternative Visions. Today we're going to turn back and address once again the Affordable Care Act. As you know, we've had previous shows on that topic. Last year, I expressed my views on the ACA, which were, to sum up, while there are some good provisions in this plan, the plan is really not going to work because it does not really control health care costs. Health care costs will continue to rise no matter how this thing is funded, ACA, which really should be thought of as a health insurance company subsidy act. The act takes money from different parts of the rest of society, and, of course, some of it includes taxes on the wealthy. That's fine, but that's only a small part, and the rest of it is to move the money around from other sectors of society in order to funnel it through the federal government in order to pay and subsidize these health insurance companies. So it doesn't really solve the key problem. And we had predicted last year that this was going to cause real upheaval with union-negotiated health care plans. And, of course, it is. And we want to talk about that today. We also said that it would result not in reduced premiums, but rising premiums by the health insurance companies. And that's also what's happening. A few weeks ago, if you remember, we had a show here with Tom Moore, an expert in the area, talking about the now escalating health care insurance premiums. So, just as we predicted last year, a lot of this is becoming true. And today, what we want to do is focus more on the impact of ACA on workers covered by union-negotiated plans. We're talking about millions of people here, folks. Because the main strategy, bargaining strategy of union labor for the last 15, 20 years has been what's called maintenance of benefits, which means workers have agreed and unions have promoted the idea of let's forego wage increases in order to keep funding our health insurance coverage. And that process continued as health insurance premiums continued to rise since the late 1990s. Double digits, and so forth. So we have this problem of moving what would be wage increases, and in some cases actually reducing wages in order to pay for rising health care costs. That's called maintenance of benefits, and to some extent also pensions were involved in that, but mostly health care. So workers have foregone wage increases for quite some time in union contracts, or agreed to not as much wage increases in order to keep their health care benefits. But we predicted that that would run into a wall by 2018 and even before that, as employers began using the ACA as a hammer in order to extract even more concessions and even more cost sharing and moving the money around. Okay. So today we're going to talk about that, and my guest is somebody who is well-versed in this particular topic. Her name is Deb Silverstein. Deb is a public school teacher for over 30 years in Ohio, and concerning our topic today is the state director for SPAN Ohio, S-P-A-N Ohio, which is the single-payer advocacy network in Ohio. As you know, my view is there is no other solution to this healthcare problem, healthcare services and cost problem, than Medicare for All. That's what's called single payer. I call it Medicare for all. I think folks can understand Medicare for all a lot easier when you raise it than saying single payer. But that's another issue. But single payer, think of it as kind of a Medicare for all solution to the problem of uninsured, which we had over 50 million. And now the claim is we have about 8-9 million less as people have gone onto these insurance exchanges. Okay, so that still leaves us with 40 million people uninsured in this country. So even this trillion-dollar ACA has not really addressed the uninsured problem and is creating other problems as well. When Obama dropped the public option back in negotiations for the ACA, that was the beginning of the end of this approach as a solution, which is really just a privatization approach. That's all this is. You know, George W. Bush tried to solve the rising price problem for health care and health insurance premiums back in during his term by creating what he called the health savings account, HSAs. Well, that was just a privatization of health care. Right? And that privatization, I mean super privatization, single person going out buying, negotiating with health insurance companies and trying to get a plan, actually no negotiations at all, take it or leave it kind of a thing with HSAs and privatization. But Obama's ACA is really in that trend, in that history. It's a privatization plan. Force people to go buy their own insurance instead of negotiating with employers. In the long run, employers love this. They want to get out of the health insurance game. They don't want to pay this premiums and so forth. They want to reduce their costs even further. They've kept wages for rising for over a decade, and now they want to do the same with benefits. They've already pretty much undermined defined benefit pension plans by shifting 401Ks. So 401Ks, HSAs, ACA, this is all the same monkey, and workers don't benefit from it at all. Okay, the short-term problem here, the short-term, is that in 2018, under the ACA, workers with unions that have negotiated plans, those plans are going to get hit with a 40% excise tax, 40%. In other words, Obama and the Democrats, Congress, are giving union labor until 2018 to figure out how to drop their union negotiated health care plans, or the plans are getting hit with 40% excise tax. 40%. Well, they're not going to survive. Employers are not going to pay 40% tax on these plans, and workers can't afford, after 15 years of paying more and paying more, cost shifting to them, no way they can afford. So, you know, it's really, you guys got 4 years, and then, you know, you're going to have to dump them some way, probably with some buyout. Employers will give somebody a buyout like they do, you know, when they want you to retire early. They give you a package, and they say, here, go, right? You figure out what you're going to do. Take a lump sum, get out of here. Well, it's the same thing. It's a health care lump sum package settlement. That's what they're going to do. For those who don't have a solution, those employer unions don't have a solution in 2018. But before that, it's causing havoc as well, because contracts that are expiring now that will extend past 2018 have to address the issue anyway. And that's causing all kinds of disruption even now, 4 years before 2018, and we'll talk about that a little bit more with my guest here. Longer term, this problem is not just disruption to these plans right now. Longer term, it's the 40% excise tax. So I might also add that there's also a tax on multi-employer plans that are taking effect right now. Right? Now, longer term, this 40% excise tax means how much cost increase? Well, estimates are for a family, for family coverage, $27,500 more. For an individual, $10,200 more in 2018. Well, as I said, who can afford to play that? That means these plans are going to blow up in 2018. Now, why did this happen? I want to discuss this with my guest, but I got to give everybody a little bit of an intro to this, because this is really important. You know, we've had shows here over the past 6 months with people who've been in the labor movement, union movement, 40, 50 years, and seen a time when the unions were effective in bargaining. But now unions have themselves in a corner. They allow themselves to get into a corner strategically here. And a lot of that, I believe, has to do by the two deep ties to the Democratic Party, right, which led them, in this case, to support ACA when it was introduced almost unequivocally. Right? Well, why would they do that when they knew this 2018 40% tax was coming? Well, at first, they thought, well, there's some other good things in ACA, and we can negotiate with our Democratic friends in Obama, and they'll let us off the hook here. Yeah, well, it didn't happen. They weren't let off the hook. They thought, union top national leaders thought, that they could get an exemption from the ACA and just continue on as they had in the past, negotiating health care, maintenance benefits, and so forth. Well, they found out that's not true. All their expectations about exemption fell on Obama deaf ears, and they haven't been exempted. And lately, some of the unions, like labor unions, actually went to the administration, went to Obama and said, hey, you know, if we're going to get whacked on the high end here, what about some of our members who have low wages on the low end of some of these plans? And, you know, why shouldn't they be able to get subsidies to cover you know, the health care premium costs, just as other non-union workers will get a subsidy under ACA. It's not sufficient, but it's something. Well, Obama threw them out. That's why the labor's union is so upset, and other unions, too, whose members are eligible for subsidies, but they're not getting it. So, in other words, union members are forced into the ACA, i.e. the excise 40% tax, where they have something better, but they're kept from it when they could benefit from it. They're getting beat up on both ends here, union folks are. Right? Okay, so this was a big strategy error, I think, by the national leaders of AFL-CIO and Change the Wind, thinking that their friends in the Democratic Party would let them off the hook subsequently, which they haven't been. This is where we are today. Okay. And by the way, you know, it's where we are with the economy in the first quarter of this year declining 1%. Are we headed into another recession? Well, I predicted last year that, yes, we would head into a recession in 2014. And this decline in the economy of 1% is very serious. Now, business leaders and politicians are poo-pooing it. Say, oh, it's the weather. It's the weather. Yeah, we had weather everywhere in the country? No, we didn't have weather everywhere in the country. And it's the weather could not have affected 1%. And it would have been even worse decline in the first quarter. Even worse if it weren't for people spending more on utilities. And guess what? People spending more as they introduced the ACA. So the decline's really almost 1.5%. And they say it's the weather, but, you know, the decline continued into April, the latest figures we have. So we'll have another session on this, the predictions we've been making for some time, that we will slip into another recession here in 2014. All right, but we want to focus on this ACA thing here today, right? Strikes probably will result from this, as it's disrupting already union negotiations. Okay. And you will end up with many union contracts not being re-signed because of this. People will work without a contract if they can't come to an agreement to accept the pass-on of even more costs to workers, union workers. Or you will get unions, I predict, agreeing to cut coverage in order to absorb the cost. And they will cut it first for part-time workers. And they will cut it for spouses, spousal coverage. You know. So this is the chaos we're heading into for union negotiated plans. Okay. Ah, that was a mouthful, wasn't it? Yes. Well, this whole plan is a mouthful. I want to turn to my guest here, Deb Silverstein. Deb, you there?
I am.
Good.
Hi, Jack.
How you doing?
I'm doing well.
Why don't you lay into this issue yourself? Tell us what you've been doing there with Span Ohio, what Span Ohio is, and the work it's doing, and your view, your take on this whole issue that we're facing with this big challenge to union negotiated plans as a result of the ACA.
I'd be happy to. You know, you mentioned that I was a public school teacher, and I was for 30 years. I was active in my union. I was an officer for 25 of those 30 years, and I did negotiate health care benefits and salary, and you're absolutely right. We took less salary most of the time than what we really should have taken in order to preserve health care benefits, and those health care benefits were number one to my members, and we followed their dictates on that. There was one time where we did change the health care benefits to go into a large consortium-like group, and it did save some money initially, but when looking at the analysis of school districts and their spending on health care here in Ohio, they're paying a pretty average rate right now, despite having that larger risk pool. But we're talking about with SPAN Ohio. SPAN does stand for the Single Payer Action Network of Ohio, and we advocate for a healthcare system that meets human rights standards. We aren't even close to meeting human rights standards here in the United States, and there are far, far too many people who go without the care that they need because of the way we do healthcare. It's all about the money when we're talking about healthcare for such a basic human need. When people are injured, when people are in pain, when people are ill, you know, they need reassurance, they need comfort, they need care, and they are first seen, instead of a human being in need, as a revenue source. And that's the first hurdle any patient has to jump through when they're sick or trying to make an appointment with anybody. My take on the union thing is it's going to be very far-reaching because unions have often been thought of as having some of the top plans, the best coverage. And in fact, you know, especially public sector unions, they've been known for that because wages have been lower, but their benefits have been good. And we're going to see a lot of effects there. There was an article in the Columbus Dispatch about the city of Columbus that when this Cadillac tax kicks in, that it could cost them between $5.3 million and $8.1 million in 2018 alone, you know, going up astronomically over time because health care costs do tend to rise faster than inflation, and the Cadillac tax is linked to the inflation index, not to health care costs. You know, at the time that the Affordable Care Act was being debated, my health care policy, and it was for a single person, was already $2,000 over that Cadillac tax limit. And it was a pretty average policy for the time. You know, it had a reasonable deductible and a reasonable copay. Since the enactment of the Affordable Care Act, which I call the Affordable Insurance Act because it didn't all it did was make insurance a little bit more affordable, and that's part of the purpose of the Cadillac tax, is to force people into lower cost plans, but far less coverage, a lot more out-of-pocket costs to individuals. There's no affordable care in that law.
Mm-hmm.
There's affordable screenings, they call it so-called preventives. You can go in and you can get your yearly physical and you can get your blood tests and you can get screened for this, that, and the other thing. But that doesn't prevent something from happening. That only catches it. Once you have a diagnosis, watch out, because you're on your own and you're in for some big spending on that one. But again, the Cadillac tax was meant to get people into those lower cost plans so that this is going to be the claim that, look, we're holding down the cost. But insurance is not care. Insurance is just kind of like a financial bet, and doesn't really provide care. Those lower-cost plans are going to have very high deductibles, and the thought on that is that the high deductibles will help control costs because people won't be using too much health care.
And, rationing. It's about rationing, and that's what was introduced by Bill Clinton. you know, the HMOs. That was all about rationing. Try to control costs by getting people to use healthcare services less. That's the whole strategy.
That's the false assumption that we're using it too much. The fact of the matter is, these high deductibles deter more necessary care than they do unnecessary care. You're always going to have the ones that run to the doctor at the slightest little thing. We're already dealing with them, and the financial barriers in their way are not preventing them from doing that. You know, just because you have insurance doesn't mean you run to the doctor. Back when I was working, I had an excellent insurance policy. It was only a $100 deductible and a 10% co-insurance, no additional co-pays. I mean, I avoided the doctor like the plague. I didn't like going to the doctor. You know, and I don't go there now because it's fun. You know, it's not an entertainment value type thing or a keeping up with the Joneses type thing. You know, I go when I have to because, you know, I'm sick or I have a chronic disease that needs to be monitored. So I go and I do that, and I do what I can to keep myself healthy. But at the same time, we're human, and we're all going to fall ill. We're all going to be patients, and we need to be able to access the care when we need it. What I've seen in my health care policy since that enactment is that my deductible has quintupled from what it was before the law was passed. In addition, I've got tons more copays on this, that, and the other thing. You know, to order testing strips to test my blood sugar, the last time I ordered those, it cost me $225. Next year, it's going to go up to $275 to order those.
Well, that's a good point that I didn't bring out, Deb, and that is it's not only that healthcare insurance premiums are rising, but as you point out, employers are preparing to recoup some of the anticipated costs in 2018 by raising deductibles and copays. In other words, shifting more of the cost after insurance premiums to the workers themselves. So that's happening right now.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the reasons that mine has gone up that I was given, you know, I get my health insurance through the state teacher's retirement system. And they said that they're going to continue to work to keep the premiums down below the Cadillac tax limit. And that was that's the whole reason for mine going up as much as they are.
What is the exact Cadillac tax limit? Do you know that offhand?
Yeah.
It's 20-some thousand a year, isn't it, in premiums?
It's I have it right here. It's $10,200 a year for single and $20,500 for a family coverage.
Family, okay. In premiums, that's the premium payment. Now that includes both premiums paid by the employee and the employer, right?
Correct.
Correct. Okay. $20,000-some. Well, let me just add. I have family members who are teachers, public school teachers.
Yep.
And the amount of premium that they are paying in California, they and the employer, is about $26,000 a year. Can you believe that? Doesn't it boggle your mind that people, to get the right to health care in this country, and it's not such a great plan. I mean, there's a $600 deductible. There are copays. And so forth. So, you know, it's not like the longshore workers out here in California. You know, they got a great plan. They don't pay anything. They almost went on strike when the employer proposed to have them pay $5 for every doctor visit. Everything else is 100%. Well, that kind of plan does not exist anywhere, almost, except on the longshore. But $26,000 a year in order to have a $600 deductible and copays and so forth? I mean, and of course, that's going to be taxed 40% in 2018.
Well, anything over that $20,500 will be taxed at 40%. And, you know, so if the policy costs them $28,000, it's $500 that would be taxed at 40%. I mean, 40% is pretty high, but the idea there wasn't to raise money through that revenue. Again, the idea was to force people into lower cost plans that have less coverage.
Or to get to negotiate with the employer a buyout. You know, here's a lump sum. Go on the exchanges and buy your own. And, you know, we'll just wash our hands of all this, kind of like a buyout with defined benefit pension plans, you know, here from now on, go, you know, go get your 401k and so forth.
Correct.
It's the same thing, destroying negotiated plan health care the way they destroyed pensions.
But between the pensions and the health care, what it is it's a great way for Wall Street financiers to make more money, because you can go out and you can get your health savings account, but when you withdraw money, there's quite often a service charge that goes to somebody. So not all that money goes to health care. Somebody else is making money off your having that plan. They don't offer these things for free.
You know, absolutely.
And that. So it's all to make the financiers a little bit wealthier. But what I see is going to happen, you know, none of us individually, the employers individually can't absorb all these costs. The individuals certainly can't. We don't make enough to absorb these costs. You know, the average household income in the United States is just a little over $50,000 a year. No family can afford these costs for health care, to have a policy like that. You know, what's going to happen is employers, you're right, they're going to start bringing to the table, if they're bargaining, they're going to bring to the table proposals to increase deductibles, to increase copays, so that they can maintain an insurance policy for their employees, but it's going to be shifting the costs on to the employees to get the cost of the insurance down.
And that cost shifting has been going on for almost 20 years now.
Yeah.
So it's not going to be a new process.
It's going to speed up. But,
yes.
You know, there's three things that I found that they were complaining about. They said, first of all, with the mandate to keep kids on till 26, that increased their costs. And then you have the individual mandate, more employees signed up for the coverage. And now you've got this Cadillac tax coming into effect, and that's going to increase costs tremendously. So what they have to do is they've got to be able to bring those premiums down to avoid the Cadillac tax. And, again, that's going to shift the costs onto the individual.
Reduce the coverage. In other words,
right.
You know,
right, it's going to reduce...
Or both, or a combination of both in negotiations, yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what you're going to see is, you know, it depends on the labor union. You may see some of them, you may see more strikes over it, I don't know. But you're going to see a lot of unhappy workers because of these proposals, because their insurance policies, I mean, that was what was key. For some of them, if they had somebody with a special health need, that's what was keeping them afloat financially.
Yes, yes.
You know,
or you're going to see a lot of contracts that aren't simply going to be renewed. People are going to work without a contract, not knowing,
mm-hmm.
not able to strike, maybe, not strong enough vis-a-vis the employer, able to strike,
right.
But refusing to absorb these increases. You're going to have a lot of extended no contract signings going on, you know. Or the union is going to step in, as some unions have already done, and say, okay, we're going to solve this this problem by let's exempt coverage for part-time workers, and then let's exempt coverage for spouses.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And that's going on already, by the way.
You've seen a lot of carve-outs, and I was looking at a policy paper that was put out by a union here in Ohio, and they were advocating those carve-outs, you know, for spouses, to get the spouses out to help save money. And this is for public schools, because these are taxpayer-supported, and we've not only taken a hit on the health care part, but public schools have taken a hit on funding here in Ohio as well. We'd rather fund the charter schools that don't perform as well in Ohio rather than the public schools. And so with that funding hit that they've had, the difficulty in passing local levies and higher health care costs, they're really behind the eight ball on what they have to do. And they've got to try and get some of those costs down. What we saw a lot of cost shifting from the school districts to the employees in the last 3 years when we evaluated the data. And I expect to see even more next year when I go through it again. You know, one of the things that we saw go down was payroll, but we saw healthcare costs stay relatively the same and that type of thing. But if payroll's going down, then that's because they're shedding employees. That's one of the ways they're doing it in order to make up for the increase in the payroll in the healthcare costs. The other things we saw is when payroll didn't go down, but healthcare costs did, we knew that they were passing those costs off onto employees.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an indicator, right.
Yeah, very strongly an indicator. And there was an awful lot of that was going on. But we still were able to determine that if we had a national Medicare for All or a state one, public schools in Ohio could save $1 billion a year.
Just in Ohio?
Just in Ohio, yeah.
Amazing.
Well, you know, the biggest, and when you stop and think of the whole insurance thing, you know, who gets the better rate, the company with 75 employees or the company with 2,000?
Well, that's not, everyone knows that answer.
Yeah, the company with 2,000.
Sure,
we're spreading
right.
The risk over many more people. And that's really what Medicare for All would do, is spread the risk over the largest risk pool possible, you know, that lowers those costs. But, you know, one of the other things about this Cadillac tax is that it's going to hurt people with small businesses, because they get those higher insurance rates. There may be nothing Cadillac about their plan, because the Cadillac tax is based strictly on the cost of the insurance policy,
exactly.
Not on the specifications or the benefits of that policy.
That's right.
So if you work for a small business, your costs are going to be high to begin with, and it may not be a Cadillac plan, but you may have Cadillac costs, and they're going to get hit with this. The only thing they can do, if I was a real small business, I'd drop the coverage if I was a business person, because you're not going to be able to, you know, keep up with that, although you want to be able to compete with larger businesses for employees. And that, so you're really, they're up against a rock and a hard place as well.
On this question, let me interrupt you here. On this uh-huh. question of dropping coverage, healthcare
yeah.
coverage, employers, in other words, and then saying to employees, go on to healthcare exchanges. Recently, you know, the IRS has introduced rules that
uh-huh.
says employers cannot dump workers onto the health exchanges, or they must pay a tax.
Yeah.
Okay. What's your take on that? Is that, it seems to me, if they can't drop them, what they will do is keep the plan and reduce the benefit coverage for those available, push more people onto part-time status where they don't have to pay,
mm-hmm.
where the unions agree to that. And find other ways of keeping the plan, but reducing the coverage even more, in lieu of dumping people on the exchange. In other words, the IRS rule, in my view, forces,
mm-hmm.
it comes in on the side of the employer in the negotiations with the union, and in effect forces
mm-hmm.
them to accept less coverage, less benefits for the same cost. What's your opinion?
Well, I think that a ruling applies to the large businesses. You know,
okay.
Yeah, small businesses under 50 don't have to provide benefits.
No, but over 50, there's a lot of businesses with over 50 employers, right?
Oh, and employees, yeah, there are a lot. And
employees.
Some of those are small enough that they're going to be hurt badly by this, I think.
Right.
Again, because they have such a small risk pool, and their costs are high to begin with.
Even with the larger employers, you know, I mean, what's mm-hmm. to stop them from, if the union's willing to agree to carve out part-time workers, what's to stop them from converting more of their full-time to part-time in order to reduce the cost of health insurance payments by the employer?
Nothing prevents them, you know, if the union can't stop them, if there's no contractual agreement on how that's done. For example, the city of Akron reduced many of their workers to below 30 hours because of the Affordable Care Act. Both the University of Akron and Kent State University, that are right in my backyard, reduced all their adjunct teaching staff to under 30 hours so that they would not have to provide benefits for them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, adjunct teaching staff make up about 50% nationwide of the teaching staff at universities and colleges. So this is a huge number of people that could be affected. And I see that as a move that they'll make. The other thing that they're doing is that they're bringing in temporary workers that they don't have to pay benefits to. And temporary usually would come in for a month or 6 weeks to fill in for a leave or an illness and that type of thing. But we're seeing workers being kept on for 6 months up to a year in temporary status.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then they let them go and bring in a new temporary worker in their place.
Yep. Yep,
so a lot of instability in the workplace.
Well, there's over, you know, we have a workforce of 155 million roughly in this country, and my estimates are if you take all the involuntary part-timers mm-hmm. and you take all the temps and those that still have without a job, you've got over 50 million people.
Mm-hmm.
That was one-third, roughly one-third, are working in a second-class citizenship arrangement with no security, half pay, no benefits, or they have, you know, they're totally unemployed, or they went on disability in order to avoid being dropped off of unemployment insurance, et cetera. Over 50 million people in this country now.
Mm-hmm.
One third are in this kind of condition. Well, no wonder they can't get consumption going and the economy going. Well, people aren't making any money to buy any of this stuff, and now they're laying this health care thing right on top of everyone else. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, we're going to find that's going to make it even more difficult for recovery to occur.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and I find myself doing those exact same things as cutting back on, you know, what I spend. With my high deductible, I recently had a bout with a kidney stone and put off going to the ER for about 36 hours until I just could not take the pain anymore. And the reason I put off going to the ER was because of the cost.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a case where that high deductible was preventing the access of necessary care and that type of thing. But now I know I've got to pay for that ER visit somehow, and I'm not sure how I'm going to do it. You know, it's all going to be on me. So I'm looking at, well, what can I cut out? If I can cut out the summer vacation, that saves me $0 because I wasn't going to take one anyways. You know, those are the kind of choices that you're making. You know, well, okay, I can't really afford meat this week.
What can you tell us about what's happening in Ohio with Ohio unions' responses to this Cadillac tax, short-term and long-term, and other issues related to the ACA? What have you been hearing about what unions in Ohio think about this and what they're trying to do about this?
We haven't been hearing very much from the unions. I did ask one of the affiliate AFL-CIO unions about the, especially the Taft-Hartley plans, and the Taft-Hartley plans cover workers a lot in the construction trades. They work for multi-employers
mm-hmm.
and that type of thing. And many times they can be low-income workers, the ones you were talking about.
Yes.
And that type of thing. And those plans, you know, really helped those people to gain coverage and stuff. But those plans especially are going to be hurt by this. And I asked what their reaction was going to be, and it was, well, those employers are probably just going to drop them. And I think they were just kind of resigned to that fact, which really is, I mean, I almost wanted to shake that person right then and there and say, you've got to fight, you've got to fight. Not necessarily to preserve the current system, but you've got to wake up and try and change the whole system so that it works for all of us.
Well, that's what we've been talking about on this show on numerous occasions here about union strategy at a strategic dead end, not only in organizing but in bargaining and so forth, and a total reconsideration is needed in mm-hmm. terms of this strategy, which is not working for 20 years now. I mean, how much longer do we have to go on fundamentally, you know, consider
what we need
to do to change?
And what we're seeing here in Ohio, too, are more and more attacks, you know, the right-to-work attacks. We had one back in 2011 that, you know, we overturned, which Senate Bill 5, and that one primarily affected public employees. They figured they could go after them first, but unlike Wisconsin, Ohio made the mistake of keeping police and fire in that law, and that one was overturned at the ballot very easily by a 2-to-1 margin. But we're expecting another attack, another right-to-work attack coming up after the November elections, either in the lame duck session or early in the next session. And so the unions here are kind of embattled, you know, on all fronts. They've got the health care issue and what they're facing, you know, with some of the loss of these plans or loss of coverage, you know, or comprehensive coverage for their members, and dealing with that. And then they've got this other attack that's coming at them as well. And so what they're doing is they're really just beefing up the war chest for what they have to, they know they're going to face coming up. But I think one of the things that the unions, you know, they were looking to see, you know, how can we be more relevant to the community and how can we be a part of the community and that type of thing. And what kept coming up over and over again were a lot of the laws that are in effect now that are standard operating procedure for employment, you know, the 40-hour work week, overtime, so on and so forth. You know, those things, you know, were brought about by unions. These were big victories by unions, which became the standard and the norm for all working people. And unions really, whether they want to or not, do, in a way, represent all working Americans because their victories are so widespread. The problem is that you can't just rest on those past victories. And when I came into the workforce, that was the norm. The relationship to the unions was gone. Now, my dad, who never was a member of the union, was a big union supporter because he grew up during the time when the unions were winning those victories, and he knew the relationship. And he always told me, he says, there's not a single benefit I have in my job that was not won by the unions, and that's why I have them. And that, and that kind of a relationship has to go back into effect, I think, because people don't see the relevance, and even some of the members, you know, trying to get the members to be motivated and active is difficult for some of them.
Well, as you point out, it's a different generation today,
yeah,
who have never gone through the fights.
Right.
You know, it's in the fight that you understand the importance of solidarity, and you can really see the effect and influence you can have collectively. But if people don't go through that process, then their understanding of what a union is quite different than people who see what a union can do in practice. And I think that's part of our problem today, and that's even true with leaderships in the unions. They've never really fought a fight, so they don't know how to do it. So they're therefore inclined not to want to do it, and then that's reinforced by their members who haven't done it either. You know, I mean, if you look at the public school teachers in Chicago, I bet those teachers have a different understanding of union than they do in some of the other cities where they've never had to fight in order to get their benefits and their wages. You know, I mean, in this system, no one gives you anything for free.
For free. No.
Nobody.
You have to fight for everything
you
that you get. You
have to scrape and fight for everything. And if you don't want to do it, then those who are running the show will, little by little, take away a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more every year. And before you know it, you turn around and you don't have anything.
Well, and I keep hearing, well, maybe it has to get worse before it can get better. Well, how much worse can we let it go?
No, it's not. That's not the answer. The answer is, that's not the problem. The problem is, I believe, organization and leadership in this particular period.
But that's
a question we've been grappling with on the show, on other shows. You know, what is it that's changed in organized labor that is responsible for this long-term decline that we're witnessing? Yes, the employer's aggressiveness is part of the problem. Yes, the laws. Yes, the government, Democrats who don't give a damn about union folks anymore, and all of that. Yes, yes. But You know, you can't exempt. You can't exempt the leadership, and you can't exempt the other, you know, what we're not doing right on our side. Now, I don't want to sound like it's all the leadership, because it's not. You know, you get the leaders that you deserve, almost. You know, if you're not going to insist on changes, then you're going to get the leadership who would rather go play golf with Democrats in Washington, you know, and they get to come to the White House and sit down and have lunch once in a while. It makes them feel like they're important, you know, and the Democrat politicians stroke them, make them feel they're important, and that's what you got. You know, I mean, my view is somehow we got to figure out how at the local union level we can get folks together with the communities, not just the union folks, but all union community. We got to change the local union form of organization. That's what has to change if we're going to resurrect anything from the bottom up, because that's not coming from the top down. That's for damn sure. So people have to do it themselves from the bottom up, but that's going to take a different strategy and a different form of organization, I believe, which I'll be writing and talking about, throwing in my two cents for what it's worth on that topic. But, you know, one of the first things that have to be confronted is this question of health care. And, you know, you're with Span Ohio. I believe the only solution, make it simple, clear solution, you know, Medicare for all. That's what it's got to be. That's the only solution to this health care problem long run, or else we're going to continue getting Clinton health maintenance organizations and Bush's health savings accounts and Obama's Affordable Care Acts, which is all about rationing and pushing the cost for less coverage onto the workers themselves and forcing them to negotiate individually on the health care exchanges, no negotiations, in other words, as a solution. The solution to the rising health care cost is get less benefits and pay more for them. That's what they see for 20-some years now, they, the politicians, is the solution. Well, that's not a solution. That's making the person who needs health care pay the full weight of the rising cost of health care. And as you pointed out in an earlier
comment, that's at an age where you can't afford to do it, too.
Yeah, that's right. And as you pointed out, why are these health insurance premiums rising so much? Well, because these health insurance companies are part of Wall Street now. Yeah. Wall Street wants a 20-22% return on their money. And, well, why... why are these health insurance companies willing to borrow from Wall Street and pay that return? Because they want to go out and merge and acquire their competitors so they can raise prices so that we can pay more. It's a vicious cycle. But Wall Street has its claws into this industry like never before, and the insurance companies love it because insurance companies are finance companies. You think insurance companies make their money from premiums? No. They make their money from getting deposits, premiums from us, and then they go and they speculate in financial securities all around the world. They're just like banks. And then when they get in trouble, they got to raise their prices more on us to pay for the cost of all this speculation going on.
Well, you know, I found it really ironic during all of the debates on health care that people had such a fear of government-run health care, and that was the fear that was put into them by the opponents of the Affordable Care Act, constantly calling it government-run health care. But really what it is corporate Wall Street-run health care.
Yes, that's the sum. That's a great way of putting it. Corporate Wall Street-run health care, where they got to take more for themselves and we got to therefore pay more and or accept less for ourselves.
Well,
that's
the care that you're going to have covered is going to be totally dependent on the profits because they are financially, fiduciarily responsible to their stockholders first, not you, the policyholder.
Yes, who's their customer? Their customer is their investor, not you know, the individual. Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and, you know, it's hard to understand when you think about it. Medicare, one of the most successful programs this country has ever had. Think about it. Think about it. You pay 1.45% of your payroll tax when you're working, you know, and then you get almost total coverage when you retire. I mean,
right.
What better deal? You know, my family member is paying over a third of her wage for this coverage.
Yeah.
For healthcare care, a third, 30%, folks, we're paying a 30% premium for healthcare coverage, whereas Medicare, 1.45%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why didn't we fight more for, and in fact, Obama and Democrats wouldn't even allow the discussion on let's have Medicare for all, or what you call single payer. They
mm-hmm.
wouldn't even allow it in debating the bill.
No,
that tells you something.
Yeah, and it really, that was, well, you have to understand that, you know, it's all run by the financial people anyways. And, you know, the insurance industry, they spent more money lobbying on that particular bill, insurance and big pharma, than ever before. The other time that we had the largest amount spent was also back in, I think it was the Truman days, when he wanted a national health insurance plan, and they came out against him and Oscar Ewing, that released the report on health in America and suggested that national insurance plan. And everything along the line, you know, all the way down, has always been a compromise of some sort. Medicare itself was a compromise from national insurance, because they picked the populations that they thought people were sympathetic to, the elderly who couldn't get insurance, many of them, and the disabled, and they applied it to them first. And the original intent with Medicare was to expand it until it included everyone. They thought
mm-hmm.
they might go into kiddie care next
mm-hmm.
and cover children, and then eventually lower the age for eligibility for Medicare, and then and creep it upwards a little bit as well,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
until they had the entire population covered. But we never continued with those steps.
Well, we sort of did. We expanded Medicaid for
yes,
the poor.
Yes, we expanded
from the bottom,
Medicaid.
From the bottom. And children, you know, skip for,
right.
for the kids, right? But what that means is not making employers' insurance companies pay, making the taxpayer pay.
Yeah, the taxpayer's paying on those. But if you look at Medicare itself, it's a very financially lean system.
It's very efficient. It's incredibly
yeah, very efficient.
You know?
And, you know, the doctors that get involved with us, they tell us, you know, Medicare pays. You know, they don't pay big bucks, but they pay timely. I don't have
mm-hmm.
to wait for payment like I do mm-hmm. with, you know, regular insurance companies.
And yeah, regular insurance companies have these policies of challenging doctors all the time and
uh-huh.
forcing doctors to resubmit, so the doctors get all frustrated with it and give up. You know?
Oh, well,
that's part of their strategy.
Yeah, the doctors give up. The patients, well, sometimes the patients don't even know, you know, to try and fight a decision
right.
by an insurance company. And that's a sad thing, because they think, okay, well, I guess it's not covered. I have to pay this.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they set about trying to do that and really hurt themselves when it should have been a covered expense. You know, I had one bill that it took me 11 months to get the insurance company to pay on. But I told them, I said, I know that this is probably one of your 10% automatically rejected of bona fide, mm-hmm. you know, claims, but you picked on the wrong person here. I'm not giving up.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, well, as you said, 10% automatically. They figure people will go away and they'll save that money. They got all this down actuarially, you know. They know what
right.
they can make. You know,
right.
And they play it. They, the insurance companies, play it. They play the doctors, they play the patients, and they pocket
mm-hmm.
pocket the rest, you know, as a result. But, you know, Medicare for all, single payer, most efficient system we've ever had, the cheapest, 1.45%, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They, you know, there's talk about, Medicare costs are going up. They're going up. And, well, that's because there's no controls on Part D prescription drugs.
That's
know?
The biggest part of it.
That's
is
the only part. That's the only
lack
part
of
Medicare
ability.
That's really out of control, because it was passed by George Bush, under George Bush in 2005, and they never provided a tax for it. It was to be financed totally out of deficits.
Yeah.
And totally. That's the problem. The rest of it is totally covered. In fact, the Social Security mm-hmm. Medicare trustees estimate that even with 70 million baby boomers going into retirement, If they simply increased the payroll tax by 0.25% mm-hmm. now and another 0.25% 10 years from now, all that would be covered. No problem.
Amazing, isn't it?
Isn't it? 0.25%. You wouldn't even see it.
You
know,
no,
it'd
you
be
wouldn't.
The cost of a coffee, you know, a
yeah.
latte in your weekly pay, right? You wouldn't
yeah,
even
my,
see
in my
it.
My yearly pay.
The problem.
In my yearly pay, it would be minuscule because I've heard those figures before, and I came home, sat down, figured out that for me it's going to be less than $50 a year. I would
right.
gladly pay that $50 a year to have good comprehensive coverage, which I don't have right now.
Right, right. Well, the only
and
solution
I, even though
is
I'm paying
Medicare for all.
$200 a month,
yeah.
you know. And,
but what does this say about politicians and political parties, you know, that won't even bring this discussion up, won't even allow it, won't even allow the discussion to occur when they pass this trillion dollar aborted legislation called the Affordable Care Act that, yes, benefits some, but at huge cost to everybody else.
No.
What do you say about politicians and parties that won't even allow that discussion to occur?
You know, to me, I find it reprehensible that if we will not allow the discussion to occur, the worst thing that you can do is to not allow free discussion of all solutions. And that was morally wrong, in my book, is to not allow that free discussion of all solutions, and including the single-payer solution, Medicare for All solution. You know, you cannot evaluate and you cannot come up with a plan unless you're considering all possibilities. And when you immediately rule one out and throw it off the table, then you've hurt everybody.
Yes, well, you know, Thomas Jefferson, a big advocate of democracy in the mm-hmm. founding of the country here, made it very clear that democracy, for it to work, had to include a free flow of information for everybody. For the people to really rule, they had to know the facts and what was going on.
Absolutely.
That was necessary.
And I think that's one of the most dangerous attacks that we're seeing now, is we're seeing that information stop flowing. We see the attacks on our school systems, and we may be subjugating our kids to, well, the poor kids. The rich kids will still go off to the very nice, good schools.
Mm-hmm.
But the poor kids and the middle-class kids are going to get substandard educations as we reduce our support of public schools. And there goes equality. You know, you reduce equality and introduce greater inequality when you do that, because you don't all have the same opportunities. But we see that in the major manipulations of our news media. They're owned by how many individuals?
Just a handful.
Just a handful that control the news. And so what news do you get? You don't get – there are some important things happening that you don't find on mainstream media. You have to go hunting and looking for that information. And we see that all the time around us. And the American people know less and less and less about the world that's going on. They know very little about the political process. They have been taught that politics and the government are evil and are the bane of their existence. Yet if they would get involved, then that government would be far more responsive to them. And the biggest reason government gets away with a lot of it is because an awful lot of people, 50% of us, don't even vote.
Well, I really think that this crisis with the ACA and mm-hmm. union negotiated plans is going to be so big that what labor needs to do, the national leadership won't do it. They're too close to the Democrats. But I think what leaders of important local unions need to do is to have a national conference
mm-hmm.
and to get together and discuss what do we do to check this crisis that's coming and our union negotiated plans. They should not just agree to cut out part-time and spouses and so forth, take the easy way out. Those people ought to be thrown out of office who, you know, just shrug, as you say.
Now, I'd like to see the unions come out and demand good quality comprehensive Medicare for all.
Well, there needs to be a conference, I think, of local union leaders who will try to lay out another strategy
mm-hmm.
for addressing the crisis in health care coverage and health care insurance and everything. And the union local people leadership should take the lead on this, because their national union people won't do it, but they need to do it. And they need to come up with a whole new strategy of how we negotiate and how we deal with the health care crisis in this country. And we could put in the retirement and pension crisis in that same discussion as well. But, boy, something needs to be done from the bottom up real quick, or folks are going to end up with a not even a third world health care coverage system here by 2020. Okay,
oh,
Deb, I'm going to really thank you. We're getting the signal here that we're out of time. I really appreciate your great insight on this question of the
ACA
and unions. And we're going to see if we can get somebody on here who's actually in future weeks actually been in negotiations and dealing with this problem. Okay?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So
thank
next
you.
Week, folks, come on, and we're going to talk about another problem, which is what's going on with the administration's environmental proposals with regard to industrial CO2 plant emissions. New rules coming out next week. We're going to discuss those new rules. What do they really mean? Is this a plum that the Democrats and Obama are throwing at the environmental movement as they plan to agree to the XL pipeline? We'll discuss that next week. Alternative Visions.